So we're ready to begin, and because it's almost 8 o'clock, so it's about an hour after we thought. If anyone has to leave before the presentation is over, please feel free to leave. Okay, but thank you for being patient to wait. So, okay. So this is a pilgrimage that I led 4 years ago to the sites in Nepal and India, and this is following very much in the instructions that the Buddha himself gave as he was approaching his passing. He said it would be very good for people to visit the major pilgrimage sites, the places that were very important in his lifetime, that there's a very strong inspiration and blessing. And there are quite a number of pilgrimage sites. There's kind of four major ones and four minor ones. And I basically went to all of them except one. And the four major places are listed here, where he was born in Lumbini, where he attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, where he gave the first teaching on the Four Noble Truths in Sarnath, and then where he passed away. And this isn't a really easy to see map, but it's the best I had. So basically what happens is this pilgrimage is going to start in Nepal, in Kathmandu. Then after being in Kathmandu and Copan for a while, we're going to go out to Lumbini, which is just across the border into Nepal from India. That's where the Buddha was born. Then from there we cross into India, and we visit two major sites, Shravasti, where he spent rainy seasons, and then Kushinagar, where he passed away. And then after that, we move down to Varanasi on the Ganges River, and it's a suburb of Varanasi where the deer park is, where he taught. And then we go into this state, which is Bihar, and we go to Nalanda Nalanda University and Rajgir, where he taught the Heart Sutra, and then we end up in Bodh Gaya. We end up in the place of enlightenment. So we're starting here, down into Uttar Pradesh, into Bihar, and ending in Bodh Gaya. Okay. And just to let you know, Delhi is up here if you want to orient yourself to where all of this is. So we start with Lumbini. And that, first to just go through some of the pictures from the book, just to set up where these pilgrimage sites, what happened to these pilgrimage sites. So Lumbini is where he was born. Bodh Gaya, where he defeated Mara under the Bodhi tree and achieved enlightenment. Sarnath, where he first turned the wheel of Dharma. And then Kushinagar, where he passed away. So the pilgrimage starts, we met in Kathmandu Valley, where the famous Bodhanath Stupa is. And a lot of things that were clear and easy to see 30 and 40 years ago are harder to see now because everything has been built up more. So from where this picture is taken, you should be able to see the whole stupa. You could in the past. But all of this has been built up a lot, so some of these. It could be, but I don't think so. It could be though. So in Kathmandu's, this is a picture of the Bodhisattva from some time ago. So here, this is a circumambulatory path around Copan. Now Copan, in the old days, was about a 20-minute walk from here. So it's on a hill not far from the Bodhisattva. So we go up to Copan, and Copan has been totally redone. Of course, since then they had the earthquake, so a few of these structures in this picture are probably rebuilt or in the process of being rebuilt now. Um, But one of the things that's significant is that the city of Kathmandu is very, very polluted with smoke from brick factories and the like. But when you get up to Kopan, which is on a hill, it's like entering a pure land. It's very, very clear, very beautiful there. But the Kathmandu Valley, other than when you're high up in a place like Kopan, is pretty sucked in by smog. And you'll get a sense of that as we make our way through Kathmandu in a little bit.
Is that where the old Gompa used to be?
Yeah. And
where's the Tara tree?
Right there. But the Tara statue is no longer under that tree.
Uh-huh.
It's been taken inside one of the buildings.
I used to climb up in there, way up to the top, and meditate at night.
Yeah, Wendy, I think because we're starting late, we're just going to have to go through.
Okay.
So we're going to circumambulate the top of Kopan right now. We pass through this area where they put up all these stupas. And this is one of the halls where the students study. And then at the back of the hill, this is a stupa that was built for a lama who came and resided at Kopan at the end of his life, Lama Kunchok. If you've ever seen the documentary, The Unmistaken Child, it's about finding his incarnation. And when you go to Kopan, there's one room that has all the relics of Geshe Lama Kunchok, and another room that has all the relics of Lama Lundrup. And they're amazing relics, you know, like a tooth which is in the process of turning into a Dorje.
Wow.
Yeah, they're really extraordinary things. These were found in the cremation, you know, when the bodies were cremated, and they went through it, they found all of these elements, and they're super amazing. So this is our group. There was 12 or 13 of us from different countries, and this picture was taken shortly before we left Kopan, and this picture was taken a little bit later, but I included it because that other picture didn't have our guide,
Amber
Tamang. Yeah. Wonderful person. He's guided quite a number of the pilgrimages that have been led by Amy Miller and Venerable Rabina and so forth. Wonderful, wonderful person. So now we're heading from one side of Kathmandu, where the Bodhinath stupa is, to the other side where the Swayambhunath stupa is. And we're going through Kathmandu. And I'm not going to make this excruciatingly long because it's basically a picture of traffic. So this is the little van that we were going in. And
the roads are big enough now to get this through
there. Wow. So once you get onto the roads, it's quite crowded. There's a ring road around it, and it's completely filled with traffic. You get some sense of it. And here you see this woman is wearing like a face mask, and a lot of people do that. And that's true for a lot of cities, especially in Asia. A lot of people wear surgical masks. So then we reach where the Swayambhunath stupa is. It's on a hill on another side of Kathmandu. And here's the steps leading up to the top of Swayambhu Hill. And when you reach the top, you come to this stupa. And as is true everywhere, you'll have a major stupa, and then you'll have all sorts of monuments around it. And people doing pujas. It could be Buddhist, because Buddhist. It could be Hindu, I should say, because especially in Nepal, but also in India, a pilgrimage site for Buddhists is also a pilgrimage site for Hindus. But in Nepal, there is indigenous Buddhists there called Newaris. I can't tell by looking at it whether this is a Newari Buddhist puja or a Hindu puja. Then, very right next to the Swayambhu Stupa, there's a entranceway. You can only go this far into it, but if you could go through that door, you get down into a shaft that goes way down into the hill. And this is where many centuries ago, Nagarjuna, the founder of the Madhyamaka system, went to retrieve the perfection of wisdom in 100,000 stanzas, which had been entrusted to the Nagas, who lived in the lake that had been formed. And so this site, Swayambhu, is exceedingly important because it's like the fountain from which we receive the perfection of wisdom sutras. And this is an image of the meditational deity of Prajnaparamita herself, who holds a copy of the text in one of her left hands. So then we're leaving the Kathmandu Valley just to go south to a place called Parping. And Parping is a place where early meditators on Vajrayogini achieved rainbow body. It's a place where Guru Rinpoche went and meditated in caves. It's a place where Tara statues are emerging from the rock, and I have pictures of all of those. So this is some of these pictures were taken like 30 or 40 years ago in the Kathmandu Valley. The same picture taken these days would be filled with lots of buildings that aren't there now. But the Kathmandu Valley, well, it is a valley. It's like a bowl. And in the past, it was a lake. And now the fields around it are terraced fields. And there you can see the high Himalayas in the background. And, wait a minute, sorry, I hit the wrong button. So this is up in the Kopan Hill about 40 years ago. And when we had the meditation courses up there, November and December, you wake up in the morning and the whole valley is filled with this fog, like clouds. So it actually looks like a lake. It looks like a lake of shaving cream or fog. So it's you can get an idea that at one time this was a lake. This bowl was a lake. And it looks like that in the winter mornings. So here is the legend of how the Kathmandu Valley was created. There's the valley with the lake, and in the lake it was the self-created light of Swayambhu, spirit of enlightenment. And Manjushri, the Buddha of wisdom, his home is in China, on the Five Peak Mountain in China. And in his meditation, he realized that if he came to the Kathmandu Valley and drained the valley, it would be a place for Buddhist pilgrimage. And so here in this picture, sorry, I hit the wrong button again. Okay, so here in this picture, this is not so clear, it gets clearer later, you'll see Manjushri with his sword of wisdom cutting an opening in the lake so all the water will drain out. So that place where that happened is called Chobar, and Parping, where we're going to, is outside the Kathmandu Valley passing the gorge. So we're going to make our way from Kathmandu Valley out through the Chobar Gorge. So there's Manjushri with his flaming sword of wisdom, and there he is cutting the edge of the lake, and the water is rushing out. And even nowadays, a river runs out through that gorge from the Kathmandu Valley. And when you go there, this is what the gorge looks like. I mean, it really looks like a cut made with a sword. You know, I guess geologists will say it's an earthquake or something like that. But certainly the outline of the story is true, that it was a lake, it opened up, the water drained out, and the valley was left. whether it was because of Manjushri's sword or not, depends which story you like.
Was there an actual person, Manjushri?
There was at the time of Buddha, but wait a minute. Sorry, folks. This is having a life of its own. It was a meditational deity based on a figure that was alive when Buddha was alive. So here, this is a more a modern-day picture of what the Kathmandu Valley looks like. And in this part of it, there's a hill, and on top of it is where the Swayambhu Stupa is, right? Of course, when the when the lake drained, there were no buildings left. There was just the hill, and then it was on top of the hill that Swayambhu was encased in this, eventually encased in this stupa. So that's what it looks, well, a few years ago anyway. On top of the hill is the spire of Swayambhu Stupa, and just happened to catch a rainbow at the same time. So we leave the valley, and on the way out we pass through Chobar, and this is the approach to where you can see the gorge. So on that bridge looking in, and that's the cut where the water went out. And then we continue on to Parping itself, and Parping also is a hill. Well, Parping is a village, but then there's a hill there, and a lot of the famous sites are up on top of the hill. So we're going to climb up the hill together. So these are the steps leading up, and it continues much higher. But at the top here, through this gateway, you get quite a lovely view down into Parping. And then here, this is the temple where the Padinka brothers, who were two of the very earliest members of the Vajrayogini lineage. They were disciples of Naropa. They received Vajrayogini directly from him, and they achieved rainbow body here. So very, very often, Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa would come here, and they would do Vajrayogini puja at this site, because it's such a powerful site for Vajrayogini practitioners. Then, just a short distance away from there, there's a cave. This is the entrance. This is the entrance to the cave.
Well, they fixed it all up.
And this is quite amazing, because this isn't the only place where you find this phenomena, but there are places where Guru Rinpoche has left his handprint in the rock. And it really is like the rock becomes like liquid, and he just puts his hand in it. It's definitely not a carving. You can see it, you know. And there's some other places in the valley that I visited where also Guru Rinpoche left his handprint or his footprint. This is said to be possible when you gain control over the inner elements. You also gain control over the outer elements. And again, a very short distance away from there is this rock, which is having a Tara image emerge. And this is something I've seen for myself, because I was there about 40 years ago, and then again about 20 years ago, and then again just a couple of years ago. And the image gets clearer and clearer and clearer over time. So it's emerging.
It was just starting to come out of the rock in 1974.
Yeah, so it's, oh, sorry. And if you wonder what all this color is, when the Nepalis go on pilgrimage, they like to have colored dyes, and they make offerings, color offerings, by putting this color powder on holy objects. So, you know, this red and this yellow, that's not part of the rock, but it's decorations that devout pilgrims put there. So now we're going to leave Kathmandu and fly from Kathmandu to Bairawa, and Bairawa is quite close to Lumbini, where the Buddha was born. So it's a very short flight. I don't remember, half an hour at the most, I think, west of Kathmandu. So we gathered our stuff together at Koh Phan and flew, and just some pictures from the plane window of the high Himalayas. This is probably around the Annapurna range, something like that, Dalagiri and Annapurna. You know, this is quite a bit to the west of Everest, but these are very, very high mountains, among the highest mountains in the world. And then when we reached there, then we met up with our driver, who had come from India, driver and his assistant, and they drove us around to all the rest of the places on this trip, from here to Bodh Gaya, in a very nice bus. And here you can see part of the cabin of the bus, and Amber was sitting up front in this part of the trip. And then we made it to Lumbini, and I hadn't been to Lumbini in 40 years. And when I was there first, all there was one Sakya Gompa and virtually nothing else. Now there's tons and tons of stuff, plus a really first-class hotel. And one of the things about this pilgrimage is I stayed at better hotels on this pilgrimage than I've stayed on in the United States or Europe, right? So one morning we left and we made our way towards the birthplace itself, which is, you know, a short walk. And I passed the Sakya Gompa, which is where I had stayed when I was there 40 years before. And this is the garden behind the Sakya Gompa, moving towards the birthplace itself. And at the time of Buddha, Lumbini was famous for its pleasure gardens. And it was while passing through that that Buddha's mother gave birth to him. And when I went there 40 years ago, there was very little. But Uttam from the Secretary General of the United Nations made a big effort to revitalize Lumbini and turn it back into pleasure gardens, you know. So lots and lots of trees were planted, and it's really kind of astounding the way it looks now. And many, many, many temples and gompas. So on the way, we passed this this kind of swampy area. And that fascinated me, because then you can really see how lotuses grow out of the mud, but unstained by the mud, which is why lotuses are such a powerful image of enlightenment. So here we are on the grounds of the birthplace, and almost all of the pilgrimage sites are like this. There's the hustle and bustle of Nepal and India on the outside. But once you actually reach the place, then by and large, it's like a beautiful park. And it's a real refuge.
What time of year were you there?
Let me go back to the first slide at the end, because I don't actually remember, but it was written on the first slide.
But it looks like early fall.
I don't know, but we can find the answer to that at the end. I'll go back to the first slide, because I don't remember. I don't remember what month it was.
Wow.
So all of these places, of course, are pilgrimage sites, and now a lot of places are connected to Southeast Asia by direct airplane routes. And so there's lots and lots of pilgrims that come from all over the world, including various Asian countries. So you see people wearing different clothing, lay people, monks, nuns. And they're sitting and they're looking at this structure here. This is a relatively modern structure, but inside of that is the place where they discovered Buddha's birthplace. And it's funny, because just a few weeks after we left here, some research they were doing, it looked like an archaeological site when you go in through this door. They were doing some digging, and they discovered something which was proof that that was the place where Buddha was born, because they found some timbers of a structure which dated all the way back to like 500 BC.
Wow.
But even before that, they knew that this was Lumbini, even though all of these pilgrimage sites got lost in history. But there was a group of people who was able to find them, and the way they found them was by discovering these Ashoka pillars. Ashoka was this great emperor who lived about 200 years after Buddha, and he went on pilgrimage to all of these Buddhist sites, and he had pillars erected with some of the sayings of the Buddha inscribed on them. And then over time, these pillars got knocked down or buried or whatever, but people followed clues to find them. And this was mostly in the 19th century, mostly completely eccentric Englishmen who were part of the Raj, but they followed all these clues, like the diaries of the Chinese Buddhist pilgrims who went there like in the 7th century. And by following it, they found, often buried and broken, they found these pillars. And on the pillars it would say, this is the place where Buddha was born. And the pillar was created only a couple of hundred years after the Buddha. But it wasn't rediscovered until almost 2,000 years after the Buddha.
In Victorian England.
Yeah. So there's another view of the building that houses it and the Ashoka pillar.
It's really hard to see how it's changed, because when I was there was nothing there except jungle. The tree was there, the empty tank was there, and the pillar was there, and nothing else. It was just scrubland.
Yeah, it's amazing.
The teeny tiny little Sakya temple that was all beat up and burned out.
Then there's temples from so many. I couldn't count how many temples there were from all different countries. And then, of course, because it's the site of Buddha's birth, a lot of the imagery you find in the temples is about the Buddha's birth. So here, according to the story, Queen Maya gave birth holding on to the branch of a tree. So here you see her holding on to the branch of the tree, and the Buddha, young Buddha, is emerging and then is being greeted. And so the next few pictures are different temples in the area, and there's many, many temples. I think I only have pictures of about three or four of them. But beautiful, beautiful temples. And as Wendy said, none of this existed, when we went there 30 and 40 years ago.
That was 1974.
Yep, that was the year I was there first time.
Oh, it's wonderful,
Now, I'm including this picture of the rickshaw because this part of the trip to get around in Lumbini, because the distances were kind of long to walk, from where the birthplace was to where all these temples were. So we went by rickshaw, but the roads were all rutted, and my chiropractor made a fortune off of these roads, because when I got back from this trip, I had to have six adjustments from bouncing along these roads and these rickshaws.
Yeah, you can see what it used to look like.
Yeah. Now, this particular temple has extraordinary artwork in and around it. Those of you who are here to a previous presentation saw or heard mentioned that the symbol of Buddhism is a wheel, the eight-spoke wheel of the Eightfold Noble Path, flanked by two deers as a sign of the deer park where the first teaching was given. So that's there on the top of the temple. And then in front of it, some of you remember that the three aspects of enlightenment are enlightened compassion, enlightened wisdom, and enlightened skillful means, symbolized by Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, and Vajrapani. So that's right on the front of this particular temple. And then this is the grounds of it. And we're going to walk around the grounds a little bit because they have all the scenes of the Buddha's life with statues. In this picture, you can just see the back of a standing Buddha. But here, in front of it, you have offering goddesses. this is a human being, right? But the same size as her are these statues and water bowls. You know, so everything is magnified. So it's showing the offering. Like there's another view of it. So it's just like the water bowls we put on the altar, but of course many, many times bigger and as a statue. So this is that scene at dusk. Quite a magical time.
Is there a place to stay in the beginning?
Well, yeah, because like that first picture was a picture of the hotel we stayed in, and that was just one of many hotels. Probably the hotel I was staying on, we were staying in as a group, was probably one of the higher echelon hotels, but you have all kinds of guest houses and things. Okay. So, Lambini is where he was born, but where he grew up was Kapilavastu, which is, nowadays it's maybe an hour and a half to the west of there. Because Kapilavastu was the capital of his father's kingdom. Right? So he was born a little bit east of there, but then he grew up. The first 29 years of his life he spent in Kapilavastu. It's been a little bit difficult to identify exactly where Kapilavastu was. And it straddles the border. So there's people who think that where the capital was on the Nepalese side of the border, like Amber Tamang, who's Nepalese, he definitely thinks it's there on the Nepalese side. And then there's other people who are Indian who think Kapilavastu is on the Indian side of the border. I have a feeling both are right, because Kapilavastu wasn't just a city, it was an area, and the area I think was big enough to overlap. And anyway, there's very little left on either of those places. There's just like, you know, foundations of buildings. Very, very little left. But still, it was kind of wonderful to go there. Very quiet. And when you look through the fence and you see this mound in the distance, some of these had been stupas and just collapsed into mounds. This one, interesting story is that when Prince Siddhartha left the kingdom, his charioteer and the horse that drove, that rode him there, they had the sad duty of going back to Kapilavastu and telling the king and queen that Siddhartha had left. Very, very sad. And it was said that as they approached Kapilavastu, that the horse died of a broken heart, and that this area was a monument that was built to that horse. I don't know whether that particular story is true.
Kantaka died there.
Yeah, that's the legend. Just outside of, but it's hard to know how exact. But that story that the horse died approaching to Kapilavastu, that story goes back a long way. Whether this hill was the stupa that was built in honor of the horse, that I'm not sure. This is an American friend of mine from California named Don Broderson. And he was one of the people, his wife had been to India way in the old days. His wife was one of Lama Yeshe's first students, but he had never been. So he'd been a Buddhist student for a long, long time. But for him, this whole trip was amazing because he had a big, big background in Buddhism, but had never seen any of these places, had never been there. So he had a really wonderful, wonderful kind of life-affirming visit there, as I think you'll get a little hint of it a little bit later on. So here was I saying before that when you reach these sites, and this is a very minor site, you know, there's really virtually nothing there, but you enter it through kind of a gate, and India or Nepal, this particular place is Nepal, but it's just like India. The village is out here, and it's a typical village, but when you enter inside, it's this kind of this precinct of, you know, it's like a beautiful park. But when you go back outside, then you attract the crowd from that village and all the surrounding villages. Word goes around that there's a bus filled with tourists, and we're like the local, the television program, you know, the celebrities. So word goes around, and pretty soon people are gathering around to have their picture taken. Or I think this woman who's part of our trip, I think she actually had candy. She was giving out candies. So that, of course, attracted a lot of people. Very, very sweet people, actually. So you can see this is a very rural, very out-of-the-way place. There's no real town there. Just at most a small village. So you see people coming just to see what's happening. Yeah. And so we left Nepal and crossed over over the Indian border on our way to the next stop, which was Shravasti. Shravasti was one of the two or three places that was completely new to me. You may know that in Buddha's life, whenever there was the rainy season, kind of equivalent to our summer, because it's very, very hard to travel then, he and his followers stayed in one place, and there were different parks in different places, and of the 45 years that he taught, he spent 25 or 26 years in Shravasti. So many of the teachings of Buddha that we have, in the beginning it says, thus I have heard, and then it says, in Shravasti, one time Buddha gave this teaching. Right? So the teachings were given in all over, you know, the Vulture's Peak and, Rajgir and all of these places, but so many of them were given in Shravasti, because he spent, you know, 3 months every year for 26 years to get surrounded by his disciples who were there to receive his teachings and meditate. So again, it's a very powerful place to go because you know what happened there, and it's also very, very beautiful. It's also, again, like a really big park. So you make a border crossing at a typical Indian village. I've forgotten the name of it. It's just on the border of India and Nepal. And we thought we were going to be there for hours to go through customs. So, and then when we looked at the office, where the immigration was, we thought, oh, we're going to be here days. And they processed all of us, you know, in just about 15 minutes.
I think it's called beer gunch.
I think it might be. It might be, but I'm not sure. Now, we arrived in Shravasti, and it was getting sunset. So the first pictures are just of the first day, kind of on the outskirts of Shravasti. And there was a hill there. So we climbed this hill just to get a look at the surrounding landscape. And on this hill, there was a place that people would go and do pujas and meditate. And then the next day, there was a really nice hotel there, and the next day we actually went into the grounds of Shravasti. And this was a place that I think I could have lived the rest of my life. You know? And it wasn't that there was anything going on there, except pilgrims coming, but it was just quiet and beautiful and just really, really serene. And the only signs that it was a great Buddhist site with many monasteries and temples was the foundations, you know, the ruins. And so all you're seeing is kind of the basement level of buildings, some of which were very enormous monasteries and stupas and things like that. But that was 2,500 years ago, and now all of that, you know, fell into ruin, but is being slowly uncovered, and in some places rebuilt. So like there, again, at all of these sites, there's stupas and other buildings that have been are being constructed nowadays.
Wow.
And it's a place where not just Buddhist pilgrims come, and Hindu pilgrims, but just tourists, you know, from India itself. It's a place they come.
A lot of walking.
And, you know, again, lots of pilgrims from Southeast Asia and other parts of the world. And one of the powerful things for me was it was very easy to just kind of close your eyes halfway and imagine that it was 2,500 years ago, because the people you see are dressed in robes and they're doing the same practices that the Buddha taught then. And, you know, you could almost say nothing's changed, because mostly it's just the vegetation and the space and the atmosphere, this incredible atmosphere of devotion.
Those are Sri Lankan people.
Yeah, I think you may be right.
Is that Modi? This guy? Just before that, was his prime minister? This guy? No, right.
Yeah, it was the kind of place where you just sit and soak up the atmosphere. And also, Lama Zopa had given all kinds of instructions of the kinds of things that there's a monkey meditating. That you can do when you go to these pilgrimage sites to soak up, you know, to so that you're not just a tourist, that you're actually using it as a spiritual practice. So we had all kinds of things that we could read, you know, like the particular teachings that Buddha gave at a particular place, or a description of one of the, you know, some of the ancient visitors who went to that site. So now we're heading to Kushinagar, where he passed away. So this is kind of a roadside restaurant that we passed by. Kind of funky. And then we got into the town of Kapilavastu, Kushinagar, again, which has stupas from, this is the kind of stupa that you'd have in Burma, for example. And here's another, there's a gate, and the actual village of Kushinagar is outside, but on the inside of the gate is this basically a park. And so it's very serene and quiet on the inside, and often very, very chaotic on the outside. Oh. Now, this is the site where Buddha passed away. These trees are not ancient trees like the one in Bodh Gaya. These trees are more modern, but they were planted in this area because this is the area where Buddha passed away. And in all the depictions, he's lying between two trees. So they planted these trees as a symbol of that, and then they built a temple next to it, and inside the temple is this statue of the Buddha reclining, which is the posture that he took when he was passing away. So people come here and to pray, to meditate, and to make offerings, like gold leafing the face of the Buddha. That's what this woman is doing. Like that. And this woman is doing a similar practice, and this at the foot end of that long statue. And then we walk behind it, and here you can see some of the, you know, the uncovered foundations of the temples that go back over 1,000 years. Because the area behind this more modern building is the place where Buddha was cremated. You know, the actual cremation site after the Buddha had passed away. So here you see a bunch of pilgrims carrying offerings, mostly flowers and things like that, making their way back to where the cremation site was. And this stupa marks that area where the cremation site was. And so this scene, for example, this scene, if they had cameras 2,500 years ago, that's what it would have looked like, because they were dressed like that, you know. So it's one of those experiences where time just seems to dissolve. This area here is quite interesting, because when the Buddha's body was cremated, a dispute arose among the leaders of the eight kingdoms that where the Buddha had lived his life. Each wanted the ashes and the relics to go back to his kingdom, and they were about to fight. And then there was a Brahmin who said, "Are you guys out of your mind? If the Buddha taught loving kindness, and now you're going to fight over his relics?" So he suggested they divide it into eight groups and do, and build stupas and repositories in each of those eight kingdoms. So here, this is the site where that happened, and here's the list of the people from those groups and that received a portion of the relics. This first one, Jatashatru, he was the son of the king of Magadha, King Bimbisara, and he and his father figure very, very deeply in the life story of the Buddha. So again, when you go to these places, people take advantage of the atmosphere to meditate and do their practices. So now we're taking a longer trip from Kushinagar to Varanasi. Now, when the Buddha was alive, over 2 millennia ago, even at that time, Varanasi was an ancient city. It was an ancient holy city on the banks of the Ganges River. And it was outside of that where the Deer Park of Sarnath was located. So that this area of Varanasi and Sarnath were not only holy because of the presence of the Buddha, but these have been holy sites for at least another 500 or 1,000 years before that, right? So when you go to these places, it's really a scale of history which is way beyond anything that we are ordinarily used to in Europe or the United States, at least as far as European-centric civilization is concerned. And there's some scenes that you see even on the roads that look virtually no different than they would have looked 2,000 years ago. There's other scenes which are very different. Again, the roads are crowded with vehicles. And this is one of the places that we stopped for lunch. Looked really funky, but it was really good. I don't know the last time the health inspector visited, but the food was really good, and we didn't get sick. So this is the crowded roads on the way to Varanasi. And when we reached Varanasi, this was the hotel we stayed in. And a lot of the people on the trip went to the Ganges rivers, because there's a lot of nice things to see. But I had done that before in a previous visit, so I was much more interested in going straight to Sarnath, which is about 8 kilometers away. So a friend of mine took these pictures on the Ganges River, and I got it from him, because I wasn't there on this visit.
The Ganges is the really sacred river of India. The water is said to be really holy. And when you actually feel that water, it feels like silk.
Mm.
It doesn't feel like ordinary water at all.
Wow. So as I said, just outside of Varanasi is Sarnath. And again, everything I said before, you know, all you see is the remains of stupas and monasteries and temples. But again, the atmosphere of the place is extraordinary. And there is a very ancient stupa, which is the site of where he gave the first teaching. And again, all these pilgrims coming to this site. And there's the stupa. This is kind of the bare bones of the stupa. It's as preserved as it could be. It was much, much bigger and much more ornate than it looks now. But again, to be there and to read, for example, to read the sutra of the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, it's very amazing. It's very, very powerful. And as you see, certain parts of it, you can almost imagine what it looked like when it was new. It was completely covered with all these carvings, which would have been colored, they would have been painted. So nowadays, a lot of it is just bare facing, you know, just bare stone like this. But at least from this small patch, you can see how ornate the carvings would have been. And I think these pilgrims were from Japan. I'm not 100% sure. I think they were Japanese pilgrims. And that's another nice thing. You go around these sites, and if they're doing chanting, which they would be, as you walk around, you hear chanting in all the different languages as you walk around.
Their monk is wearing orange, so I would guess Burma or Thailand.
Could be. Sorry.
Maybe Vietnam.
I think having a little bit of problem here.
It's beautiful.
Okay, so we're leaving. So this is one of the last views of Sarnath before we left. And this trip that we made now, after leaving Sarnath, was to go to a place called Vaishali, where early Buddhist conclaves were held, and where the first nuns were ordained. And it was supposed to be about a 7 or 8 hour trip, so it was going to be a really long one. It turned out to be 16 hours. That was a really long day. So here, people attending teachings, and here on the way to Vaishali. So it started out nice. We found this really nice restaurant to eat at. This is actually a beautiful, beautiful place. Beautiful gardens like this. And then really nice huts, which is where they brought the food, which was just super beautiful. The food was really good, very, very clean. So the day started out fantastic. And then everything slowed to a crawl. And it took hours just to go, you know, just a few kilometers. And the road was filled with rickshaws and every other kind of vehicle.
Has really increased?
Felt it. Yeah. It really did. Yeah. So now here we're in Vaishali, which is, also, it wasn't one of the major Buddhist pilgrimage sites, but it was an extremely important site in the life of Buddha. He spent a lot of time there. And again, there was an Ashoka pillar with a kind of a lion capital on it. Oops. So now we're going to be heading in a basic southerly direction, and the goal is Bodh Gaya. But on the way to Bodh Gaya, we pass two places that are very important. The great monastic university of Nalanda. And those of you who have received teachings by the Dalai Lama have heard him say that the Buddhism of Tibet is actually the Buddhism of the Nalanda tradition. It's the Buddhism that grew up at this extraordinary monastery, which is like, you could think of it was like the Oxford, the Cambridge, the Sorbonne, of ancient India, and it was like a center of learning, not just for Buddhism, but for Hinduism and all arts and sciences. And then it was destroyed. It was destroyed in basically the year 1200 by invaders. It was such a huge place, and it had such a huge library, that when the library was put on fire, the fire burnt nonstop for 6 months, you know, and all those texts were destroyed. But it's still an extraordinary place, and they're slowly excavating and rebuilding sections of it. So this is the grounds of Nalanda. So we're walking down into the grounds. And that's the remains of the central stupa that used to be there. And here, this is interesting because here is a map showing the present-day excavation of all the temples whose foundations they found. But it's about, at most, 10% of the extent of Nalanda. So in all of these directions around here, you could go many fractions of a mile, and it would still be Nalanda. So there's a lot of other things still buried under these other places. The excavation only reached, as I said, 10% of the area at most. So that's the remains of what was the central stupa of Nalanda. And of course, this used to be filled with all kinds of buildings and statuaries and stupas. And see up here? You can barely make it out. But that's one statue that was too far away for them to completely destroy. So it was left. But all the other niches, all of them would have been filled with statues. Okay. And then continuing south, not far from Nalanda, is Rajgir. That's where Vulture's Peak was, and that's where the Buddha gave the Heart Sutra and the Lotus Sutra, very famous teachings. And now they've built this kind of tramway to take you up up to Vulture's Peak and past it to the very top of the hill, where it's also a famous place where the Buddha taught.
You don't have to walk up the steps anymore?
If you want to get to the very top of the hill, you can take this, but you can walk up the steps if you want. And when you walk up the steps, you get partway up the hill, you reach this platform, and this is where the Buddha taught the Heart Sutra. So, again, I didn't go. I had been there before, and I had something else I wanted to do during that part of the trip. So, again, a friend of mine took these pictures. And there's my friend Don meditating on Vulture's Peak. And so, again, this is an extraordinary place to go and read the Heart Sutra. It's a place where it was originally delivered, and where Buddha spent a lot of time. Now, one of the sites, considered one of the eight major pilgrimage sites, is the most remote and the least built up, and I've never been to it. It's called Sankasya. Rabina said she went to it, and there's virtually nothing there. But that site is important because at one point in the Buddha's life, he left the earth, and he went to the realm in which his mother had been reborn as a god, and he taught the Dharma, specifically the Abhidharma, to them to help liberate, to repay his mother's kindness.
He taught the Abhidharma there.
Yeah. And so then, after about 3 months of having disappeared, he returned, and one of his disciples used his psychic powers to see where it was he was going to return. And it was at this place called Sankhya. And you see pictures of the Buddha descending back down to earth and flanked by the Hindu gods like Indra and Brahma, like that. So this is just one representation of that scene. But there's virtually nothing there, and even though geographically it's closest to Delhi, it's actually very, very removed from every place else, because I've been told there's no real good roads there, you know, and so you really have to want to go there to go there. it's not on the way anywhere, right? And yeah,
still called by the same name.
Yeah, I think it's called Sankhyasa. Oh, well, I don't know whether that's a modern day version of the name or not, but yeah, people would know it as Sankhyasa. And then now we're in the home stretch, which is Bodh Gaya. The Tibetans call it Dorje Den, which means the diamond seat, Vajra Asana, because that's where the Buddha sat and attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. I'm going to go through these a little bit quicker, because I took a lot of pictures here, and it's getting late. It's almost 9 o'clock. So again, you enter in the town, and it's a bustling town, even more so now because the United Nations declared it a heritage site. You know, so a lot of things were done to attract tourists. So the village, which used to be a kind of small, sleepy village, has become, you know, much, much bigger and much busier as a result.
Wow.
So this is the kind of scene you see going through the village of Bodh Gaya.
My gosh, what a change.
Yeah. But also you really get an idea of India too. You know, you see village life right up front because it's all there. Like the vegetable sellers on the street.
Just waddle and daub huts before. Now they've got like three-story buildings.
Yeah. And going through the village, now you look in the background, there's the stupa. That's the site of the enlightenment. So this is the village, and you can see it's just outside of the holy precincts, you know, and then the cow symbol of
Thank
India. And now we're getting really close to where the stupa is. Well, I want to go back one thing. Wendy, when you were there and there were chai shops that were just across from the stupa, wait a minute. That was here. That was here.
Uh-huh.
And in the old days, there was nothing. Just a few
yeah.
chai shops. That was right up there. Okay, so now we're entering the sacred ground, and all the rest of the pictures basically are about the Mahabodhi stupa and the grounds right around it. Oh, that's interesting. I think that's going to be it for this. It seems like it's run out of space. Yeah, we were lucky to get as much as we did. But people really tried hard to resuscitate it. Okay. Well, maybe there'll be a way of me selecting out the pictures of Bodh Gaya and adding it to another slideshow. But that's beyond our ability at the moment. Okay. So, thank you. You've been very patient.
Thank you very much.
We'll see if we can get a way of viewing these. Showing the Bodh Gaya pictures connected with that somehow. Or a way of me sending the pictures here. And so after I leave, maybe it would be possible for you to view it, you know, through PowerPoint. We'll see if we can do that.